This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
My heart is going out to Carol Ann Duffy and her family, and hoping that all is going well. She's a poet whose work I love and admire. And I'd like to begin by reading one of her poems from Selling Manhattan. Her persona poems are amazing to me. Not that I don't always speak in a persona, but she speaks in a different persona in many of her poems and lets us experience from within characters whom we might not otherwise be imagining. This is called Stealing. The most unusual thing I ever stole, a snowman. Midnight, he looked magnificent, a tall white mute beneath the winter moon. I wanted him, a mate with a mind as cold as the slice of ice within my own brain. I started with the head. Better off dead than giving in, not taking what you want. He weighed a ton, his torso frozen stiff, hugged to my chest, a fierce chill piercing my gut. Part of the thrill was knowing that children would cry in the morning. Life's tough. Sometimes I steal things I don't need. I joyride cars to nowhere, break into houses just to have a look. I'm a mucky ghost, leave a mess, maybe pinch a camera. I watch my gloved hand twisting the doorknob. A stranger's bedroom, mirrors. I sigh like this, ah. It took some time. Reassembled in the yard, he didn't look the same. I took a run and booted him again, again. My breath ripped out in rags. It seems daft now. Then I was standing alone amongst lumps of snow, sick of the world. Boredom. Mostly I'm so bored I could eat myself. One time I stole a guitar and thought I might learn to play. I nicked a bust of Shakespeare once, flogged it, but the snowman was strangest. You don't understand a word I'm saying, do you? Carol Ann Duffy. It's been a different kind of year for all of us. And for those of us traveling around and talking to the young, and reading poems in different places, I began in September to look for other poems that I hadn't read before that I could read. And I want to start with a couple of those. They're poems in Arabic by women who lived in the 8th century. The first, Rabia al-Adawiya, was a mystic who was later canonized as an Islamic saint and lived in seclusion in the desert. And once when she needed seasoning for her food, a peeled onion dropped into the pan from a bird's mouth. That's the kind of life that she led. And this poem starts, "O my Lord." O my Lord, if I worship you from fear of hell, burn me in hell. If I worship you from hope of paradise, exclude me from that place. But if I worship you for your own sake, do not withhold from me your eternal beauty. And Laila Akyalia, lived around the same time, was married to a merchant, and was in love with a robber chief. Those were in the old days when such things still happened. And I want to read her poem, Camel. My camel kneels at Ibn Marwan's door and groans three times in birth pangs. Men circle her each night with torches lighting the hills. A leader and a youth bring companion armor and words bright as Yemen cloth. But crude milking injured her. Now softly, on the slopes of Thadak, she's given dry food. Then quickly to water, on good hoofs, fast, her body lean. Her summer offspring is unweaned, but day already smells of autumn. So there are a couple of sister poets, sibling poets, to carry with us. And this is a poem that I wrote September 18th. It's called A Week Later. A week later, I said to a friend, I don't think I could ever write about it. Maybe in a year I could write something. There is something in me maybe someday to be written. Now it is folded and folded and folded like a note in school. And in my dream, someone was playing jacks, and in the air there was a huge, thrown, tilted jack on fire. And when I woke up, I found myself counting the days since I had last seen my husband, only 2 years and some weeks and hours. We had signed the papers and come down to the ground floor of the Chrysler Building. The intact beauty of its lobby around us, like a king's tomb, on the ceiling the little painted plane in the mural flying. And it entered my strictured heart this morning, slightly, shyly, as if warily, untamed, a greater sense of the sweetness and plenty of his ongoing life, unknown to me, unseen by me, unheard, untouched, but known, seen, heard, touched. And it came to me for moments at a time, moment after moment, to be glad for him that he is with the one he feels was meant for him. And I thought of my mother, minutes from her death, 85 years from her birth, the almost warbler bones of her shoulder under my hand, the eggshell skull as she lay in some peace in the clean sheets. And I could tell her the best of my poor, partial love. I could sing her out with it. I saw the luck and luxury of that hour. The diagnosis. By the time I was 6 months old, she knew something was wrong with me. I got looks on my face she had not seen on any child in the family or the extended family or the neighborhood. My mother took me in to the pediatrician, a tall, thin man with a lantern jaw and kind hands, a doctor with a name like a soup size for a wheel, hub long. My mom did not tell him what she thought in truth, that I was possessed. It was just these strange looks on my face. He held me and conversed with me, chatting as one does with a baby. And my mother said, she's doing it now. Look, she's doing it now. And the doctor said, what your daughter has is called a sense of humor. Oh, she said. and took me back to the house where that sense would be tested and found to be incurable. I'm going to read a few poems tonight that will be in the book that comes out in the fall. And this is the first poem in the book. Unknown. On the last morning of the summer, a quiet family comes from the direction of the sea, over the dune to the far side of the pond, and lays out their cloth and sets down their lattice basket like a walnut meat or a worried forehead. One mother, one father, one toddler. Around them the breath of the earth, the surf, the massed crickets, the singing of matter coming through its narrow flute hole in out of nothing, the creased harness of the mute swan's shoulder. Music of the holy triad on the beach, rhythms of distant speech when the words are rough bouqueted by gusts. And in the back of my mind, for an instant, I wonder if this is the little family my relative killed when he was drunk with his car. But I know that the dead at the moment of death do not start out as if for vacation, showing up a year later in bathing suits, unwounded. The labor was deeply done, thorough. Then the thought of the people who loved those three springs up in my mind like a work party of love in a graveyard. Around the three holes in the ground, maybe the small one in the middle as if to be protected, but the relative, so many relatives in the human family, skilled in the irrevocable. If you know someone who was there that hour at the burial, could you tell them? I don't know what you could tell them. Across the pond, the day's neighbors open the earthen doors of the hamper. Salt for eggs, a cup of milk. If they should lack for something, if they would ask me, or sometime have they already asked me, and I did not know them. I didn't know until recently that I'm a formal poet. I believed that what I said, that I was a free verse poet. I liked thinking that, but I'm not. I'm a totally ta-da-ta-da-ta-da poet. And once I realized that, I started kind of getting into it. And so then if I could title a poem like an ode, then I thought, an ode. So cool. So this is Little End Ode. When I told my mother the joke, the new kid at college who asked where the library's at, and the sophomore who said, at Yale, we do not end our sentences with prepositions. Whereupon the frosh said, oh, I beg your pardon, where's the library at, asshole? She shrieked with delight. Asshole, she murmured fondly. She's become so fresh, rinsed with sweetness, as if she is music, the strings especially high and bright. Asshole, she sighs in contentment, maybe at the miracle that anger could be expressed and its expression bring happiness. And maybe it's the closest she's come for a while to the rich animal life she lived with her second husband. Now, I can see that, of course, she touched him everywhere, as lovers do. She touched me there, you know, courteously, with oil like myrrh. Soon after she had given me life, she gave me pleasure, which gave her pleasure. Maybe it felt to her fingertip like the complex, clean knot of her Fire Girl's tie clasp. She seems these days like a very human goddess. I do not want her to die. This feels like a new not want, a shalt not want not want. As soon as I dared, around 50, I called her, to myself, the A word. And yet, now, if she goes, when she goes, to me it is like the departure of a whole small species of singing bird from the earth. And this is Wooden Ode. Whenever I see a chair like it, I consider it. The no arms, the creaky legs, pear or cherry, the seat made of string laid down in a square spiral, the glaze poured over the string. Sometimes I'll take hold of the peneplum and lift the four-legged creature a little off the floor and rotate my wrist to hear the wind in the timbers. Yo, I will say. And the structure will not utter, just some faint music of keel rope and tether, Old Testament cradle. Whenever I see a Hitchcock chair, not a Federal or an Eames, but just the kind my folks once tied me to, I pay close furniture attention, even as my mind is taking its sea-blind cartwheels back. But if every time you saw a tree, pear, cherry, American elm, American oak, beech, bayou cypress, your eyes checked for a branch, low enough, but not too low and strong enough, and you thought of your uncle or father, brother, third cousin twice removed, murdered on a tree, then you would have the basis for a working knowledge of American history. Sometimes we write our poems soon, and sometimes it takes us 30 years to imagine or remember or invent or dream. This is called When She Slept In. Breasts full, gradually hardening with milk, little seeps going into the folded husband hankies set into the front curve of the nursing harness. I would wander the quiet apartment when her nap would last a little longer than usual. When she was awake, I was purpose. I was a soft, domestic prowling of goodness. Only when she slept was I free to think the thoughts of one in bondage. I had wanted to be someone, not someone's mom, but someone, some one. Yet I knew that this work I did with her lay at the heart of what mattered, was that heart. And still there was a part of me left out by it, as if exposed on a mountain by mothering. And when she slept in, I smelled the husks of olive rind on the slope. I heard the blue knock of the eucalyptus locket. I felt the red gold translucent ants walk me like the water under Jesus's feet. I heard the breath of the wolf seeking what would savor and enrich her milk. I smelled the bending of the cedar under the sea of the wind. While she slept, it was as if my pierced ankles loosed themselves, and I walked like a hunter in the horror joy of the unattached. Girl of a mother, mother of a girl, I paced the apartment leaking cream and honey, listening for the meaning of my life, or half my life, almost half fearing sometimes that she might have died, not wanting her awake yet, but knowing nothing was anything next to the small movements she would make as she woke, as the earth moved, light on the face of the water of creation. And then that faintest cry, like a pelagic bird who sleeps in flight. And I would turn, pivot on a spice-crushing heel, and start to sing as I approached her door. And I am still singing. I try to get ready for that line, but sometimes it creeps up on me anyway. The shyness. Then, when we were joined, I became shyer. I became completed, joyful, and shyer. I may have shined more, like a river under the moon in the wind, reflected more, and from deep inside there rose some glow passing steadily through me, but I was not playing now. I felt a little like a child in a raftered church or in a cathedral, the vaulted spaces of the human like a holy woods. The trees moaned and bent. I was quiet when my throat was not making those rich iron earth rusted noises at the hinge of matter and whatever is not matter. He takes me into the endings like another world at the center of this one. And then, if he begins to end when I am resting and I do not yet rejoin him, then I feel awe. I almost feel fear. I even feel as if I should not move or make a sound, as if he is alone now, howling in the wilderness. And yet I know we are in this place together. I thought, now is the moment I could become more loving. And my hands moved shyly over him, secret as heaven. And my mouth spoke, and in my beloved's voice, by the bones of my head, the fields groaned. And then I joined him again, not shy, not bold, released, entering the true home. Then we lay together, panting as if saved from some disaster, and for long moments it came to pass what I have heard about. It came to me that I did not know I was separate from this man. I did not know I was lonely. To our miscarried one, age 30 now. Though I never saw you, I saw your scarves, mufflers, ear puffs, your bunting gore. I was afraid of you, of how you differed from who we had wanted you to be. And it's as if you waited then, where such waiting is done, for when I would look beside me, and here you are in the world of forms, where my wifehood is now, and the loving with him, as if 1,000 years from now, you and I are in some antechamber where the differences between us are of little matter, you with perhaps not much of a head yet, dear garden one, cotyledon still bent in its pod, there with the shovels and spades and wafts of beekeeper shroud and little blue hide gloves. That he left me is a small thing to your leaving the earth, your shifting places on it and shifting shapes. You threw off your working clothes of arms and legs and moved house from uterus to toilet bowl and jointed stem and sewer out to float the river and seas in painless pieces. And yet, the idea of you has come back to where I could see you today as a small, impromptu god of the partial. When I leave for good, would you hold me in your blue mitt for the departure hence? I never thought to see you again. I never thought to seek you. One of the great things about travel, as we all know, is perspective. It gives you different perspective on the world and on yourself, especially if you are traveling and you're in a hotel room that has one of those bathrooms made of mirrors. Self-portrait, rear view. At first, I almost do not believe it in the hotel triple mirror that is my body, in back, below the waist, and above the legs, the thing that doesn't stop moving when I stop moving. And it doesn't even look like just one thing, or even one big double thing. Even the word saddlebags has a smooth calfskin feel to it, compared to this compendium of net string bags shaking their booty of cellulite fruits and nuts. Some lumps look like bonbons translated intact from chocolate box to buttocks, the curl on top showing slightly through my skin. Once I see what I can do with this, I do it, high-stepping to make the rapids of my bottom rush in ripples like a world wonder. Slowly, I believe what I am seeing, a 54-year-old rear end, once a tight end, high and mighty, almost a chicken butt, now exhausted, as if tragic. But this is not an invasion. My cul-de-sac is not being used to hatch alien cells, ball peens, gyroscopes, sacks of marbles. It's my hoard of treasure, my good luck, not to be dead yet. But when I toss the mane of my ass again and see in a clutch of eggs, each egg on its own as if shellless shudder, I wonder if anyone has ever died looking in a mirror of horror. I think I will not even catch a cold from it. I will go to school to it, to butt boot camp, to the video store where I saw in the window my hero, my workout jelly role model, my apotheosis, killer buns. One secret thing happened at the end of my mother's life when I was alone with her. I knew it should happen. I knew someone was there in there, something less unlike my mother than anything else on earth. And the jar was there on the table, the space around it round and drawn back from it like the awestruck handmade air around the creche. And her open mouth, not shut for 2 days, looked parched. I have always feared her. It was evening. No one was there. The lid eased off. I drew a finger through the jelly like egg sex essence. The four corners of the room were not creatures. If I did not do this, what was I? I rubbed the cowlick of petrolatum on the skin around where the final measures of what was almost not breath swayed, and her throat made a guttural stream bed sound like pebbly relief. But each lip was stuck by dried chap to its row of teeth, stuck fast. And then I worked for my motherhood, my humanhood. I slid my finger slowly back and forth along the scab line and underlying canines and incisors, upper lip and then lower lip, until, like a basted seam softly ripped, what had been joined was asunder. I ran the salve inside the folds, along the gums, common mercy. The secret was how deeply I did not want to touch inside her, and how much the act was an act of escape, my last chance to free myself. I'll read three more. Oh, the light's still green. I can read three more. Okay. I worked on this. The Hotel Santa Fe, I think it's much better as a result. A little harder to read. It's called Go. And it has an epigraph from Chaucer, from Troilus and Crusade, when he suddenly speaks to the book, the work of art, Troilus and Crusade, and says, "Go, little book, go, little my tragedy," sending it out into the world. Go. Then a hard-boiled egg, taken from the icebox, patted dry, bapped on the counter, peeled in moist, smasherine collops, revealed on a slope of its turgid surface a coiled hair of my boyfriend, the tiny O of the last few loops of its tip. It looked calm and alone, with a sort of daily holiness, like an inviolate soul. It looked magic from inside the chicken. Half a year since touch or sight. 6 months since I swept the kitchen to its cornermost deeps, where now I see a web, and there, suspended like a relic in its glory, the cursive scrawl of another nether hackle from his sacred corpus. Have I learned nothing, that I want to make a shrine for it? As if one keratin effluence, blah, 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 of his matter is a god and my spirit is its worshiper? As if I am not worthy so much as to gather up a crumb from under my mother's table. I'm standing near the toilet, holding the intimate ringlets when I suddenly get it, that hoarding and grief and rage and longing for the unloving lie close in me. Joy to the fishes in the deep blue sea. Go, little hair. Go, little my tragedy. I always like to read a poem I've never read before, and I especially want to read this one that has it has a lot of water in it. I'm so glad to hear of the rain and the snow a few days ago, and I wanted to read this here and now for the first time. It's called Naiad Ceremony. Early in the morning, we went through her garden, filling a big transparent bag with snippets of green redwood needles, sequoia, cedar, sugar pine, larch. And in light closed fists tore, slowly, each full bloom rose off its core of damp tongues. And we dropped in cones, tiny lemons, gardenia, jasmine, fern. And in the church the minister said, "Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord, for they rest from their labors." And he picked up the pathos pint of my mother's ashes. And we rowed them to the bay and took them on deck and cast off into the cold summer fog. Cormorant, pelican, tern, egret, whimbrel. We took her past cliff and scoured out sea tunnel. We stayed in the lee of the mouth and then came out into chop and a swell like a rearing horse on a heavy seas carousel. And the boat was toward the open sea. I pressed her little bucket of cinders against my belly and prayed to be truer to the birth I'd been given and the birth I'd given. The engines cut, the prow swung slow around toward a distant cove, and the wind dropped, and someone said, "It's time." And then I knew I was about to lose her. She was going. There was no stopping it. I was going to have to give her up, and it bent me over. Shock of abandon. Give rest, O Christ, to thy servant, with thy saints, where sorrow and pain are no more, nor sighing. He held the opened box to me, And my mother was violet gray as a blue spruce. She was a twilight gray like fur. I ran my hand in to the evening talcum of her absent action, her dreamed night flesh. And there sharp came up in my palm with her powder and the marrow shards, a tangle of burnt metal, like a wild scrawl of circles soldered together. The triple strand wedding ring she'd been wearing. It had stayed on her hand while her hand ceased to be a hand. It touched me now on the other side of the fire. Blessed, blessed, blessed. I loosed it in its damp puff of her parted flesh, which blew in a cloud of shadowed starshine and plunged like milk into the sea. Dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. And after we were done, he poured and poured and shook the rest of her out. We commend her to Almighty God. We commit her body to the deep. And we took the sack of blossoms and clippings, and we reached whole arms in, and by handfuls dropped fresh brightness and limp, buoyant sweetness in a trail above where her salts and metals had gone. We laid down a fresh path. We let her go. We ushered her forth like the death of a god, the birth of an exhausted holiday. Thank you. I'm going to close with this, which is Santa Fe, and especially here, is such a poetry home, and just the word Lannan is a word for poetry. So this has some names of some familiar characters to our tribe. It's called Animal Crackers. I liked to bite the hindquarters off the hippopotamuses and the humps off the camels. I loved tails and ears like those of the hollow chocolate rabbit who appeared in my house when Jesus rose. The indented spots on the leopard scent me, the deep engravings in the zebra's side. Sometimes I liked to save the head, then pop it in and attend to feel that brain of dumb sugar and flour added to mine. And now that I'm half old, I want some poet crackers, some smarts, some Claires, little busts or cameos of everyone to eat. I ate Christ and the bunny. I want a Whitman communion motto. I want Dickinson by her own recipe and Keats' bright oatmeal brooch. I need to read, lip read, tooth read, Ruth Stone, Langston Hughes, oh, sweet, salty Rukeyser cracker. And I would like to be one, no matter it is undeserved. I want to be in those little boxes with woven handles like shed snakeskins, edible Cannells, Cliftons, and Olds's. I wish when I am dead, I could be among the English and American animal crackers.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I'm very interested in prayer and spells. And in certain ways, they are gendered. Prayer is conventionally led by a man. Spells are conventionally cast by a witch. And I wondered if you feel that your poetry has anything in common with prayers or spells?
I think of prayer as so essential to a child's life, whether they're in a religion or not. Wish, just a wish, a hope, fear. So that seems something, yeah, that's common to us all. I like the idea of spells. I have felt them cast on me. Mostly not by female witches, as a matter of fact. I liked so much what you said, you know, in the beginning about saying it, you know, speaking out, saying it. It gave me a different picture of what we do instead of thinking exhibitionism or, you know, the bad names we call ourselves for what we do. I thought, yeah, I think that.
I was tired of that. Obviously you do know how often sensationalism, exhibitionism, you know, it's like a litany. Pornography. Oh, I think that you wanted to say something about pornography.
Yes. Yes. When I first heard that a academic critic had called my work pornographic, I looked up pornographic because I wasn't really sure what it meant. Pornos graphos, the writing by men about prostitutes who are women, which didn't sound much like my work, actually, to me. But then there's also the thing of it being sold for money and it being arousing to its clients. So I therefore knew that there was one person who got, at least, but one who got excited by my poems. I don't see them that way. I just think how awful it would be if there was something that you cared about a lot and that was curiously interesting and indescribable and universal if you couldn't try to make art out of that. It's not easy, and it's easy to make mistakes with it, but why not to try that? So I read this thing just a few days ago that said that the same critic had also said vulgar and derivative. And I got all excited because I could look up vulgar and derivative. and I can't remember exactly, but last night with some kind help, I looked up, and vulgar is something like of the regular people, like us, folks. That's vulgar. And derivative derivative, a river runs through it. Derivative. And it means, I don't know, coming from or not being completely separate from what has come before. Mm-hmm. And I thought of Dante not writing in Latin but in Italian, Chaucer not writing in Latin but in that handmade little, you know, wreck of a language that was just getting started up. It's all a family. I mean, I'm not saying that I love them and I've read them, and I'm not saying that, you know, I put myself with them, except that all of us are in the same family. Families have grown-ups, they have children. All of us are in that family. So that cheers me up about that. And, you know, just fighting back is fun.
It reminds me that Hugh Kenner, who was my teacher, once said, you know, people can't read poems if they don't know where words come from. And I remember there's a poem of Yeats's that takes place before the Christian era, and it ends, I believe, "Profane perfection of mankind." And Kenner pointed out, profane, profane, really means before the temple. Before the temple, because it was before the Christian era. And that you don't begin to know what Yeats is saying unless you can see and hear and translate what Yeats is saying. Now, of course, it helps when critics are aiming their words at us for us to deflect them with meaning.
Yes.
But it really did strike me that the work goes from the beginning on a ladder quest. It's attempting to pull itself up out of a certain condition, and that at a certain point It's not enough to pull oneself up. That's what you do with your bootstraps. The poet wants to fly. And it seemed to me that there are spells or secret combinations that allow the poetry to fly from the shame rather than to be mired or exhibitionistic or pornographic, and that what people refer to as moments of shock in your work are in fact these almost neural combinations of language that bring you up like the phoenix.
That's so sweet.
But
that's so sweet.
What do you think?
That is sweet to hear. It's sweet to hear. What do I think? I feel that that's encouraging. And I wonder what they are, though. The combinations, the spells.
Well, they change.
Like two words together that... Mm-hmm.
Well, from the beginning, Satan offers you some in the first book.
I see.
But then others are evolved. Mm-hmm. And putting unspeakable things together, I think, mm-hmm. releases mm-hmm. energy mm-hmm. in the poem, mm-hmm. and the poem becomes faster, impassioned, more mm-hmm. incantatory as it goes on. It gives itself energy. You must tell me whether you think it's true or not.
It sounds true. I know. When I was first writing, what line breaks, what running over the end of the line had to do with for me was not stopping. Not stopping with the end stopped church hymn rhyme, and not stopping, not being stopped, trying to keep going, not to say what one had been raised to believe that it was nice to say or right to say, but, you know, we want to find out what we think. And that's a connection that I make with what you're saying. It doesn't sound untrue at all. I just want to say, like, thank you, instead of, do I think it's true?
You see, if I were making this observation and it struck you as being essentially wrong, I wouldn't be interested in pursuing it further. That really, because I know that many people say that whatever a reader finds in a poem is surely there, but I don't think so. I think that what is in a poem is what a poet puts there, and that when a poet says definitively, I don't like that reading, everyone should listen and stop it.
I like everything so far.
Okay. Now, tell me, this sense of humor that you talked about, at what point did you recognize it as a sense of humor?
Well, that's a great question. Okay. We're in a movie theater, junior high, boys and girls kind of scrambled, you know, together. No, girls all in one row, boys all in another row. And people say things, they make remarks about the movie, right? And so I listen. You know, and I think I get the idea of the kinds of things they're saying. I don't remember anything that anyone said, nor what I said. But then I say one of those things, silence falls. And I think, oh, no, I guess I didn't get it. I guess it wasn't that kind of a comment. So sense of humor, I now think I have one. But it used to be that I just would say these things that weren't what the others were saying.
It's related, it seems to me, to what people have described as a profound gift for metaphor.
Like things that go through you that you can't do, but that you're a location for.
Yes.
Though you could do, like, exercises, you know, to hope for it, or let it know if you knew of how to let it know that you liked it when it happened. Yeah. see, it's like that. It was like that.
Wait. Well, I don't see why they're all laughing. It must be because they have a sense of humor, too, and I don't. but it seems to me, right, that, you know, you grow up saying, if you are interested in the arts, saying very strange things. And no one likes, I sound like Gertrude Stein here, no one likes the things you say until you have been saying them for such a long time that people recognize them as the things you say. And then they start laughing.
Right.
And at a certain point, they started laughing at Gertrude Stein, even though the things were still strange and not really funny. But by now, they were so characteristic. And I have the feeling that something like this has happened as people have gotten used to your presence and your work.
I don't know if people, whoever the people are, you know, that we're thinking about when we think of a community of critics, I don't know if they would think that my poems were funny. They might not. So I don't know if that's something that's... but I know that when I'm working at NYU or at the hospital or visiting a class that our NYU students are teaching at the hospital, within those communities, we develop jokes together, right? And, you know, I don't know. I'm thinking, you mentioned Yeats, and I'm thinking of Crazy Jane. You know, and I don't know how funny did he think those poems were, and how funny, you know, are they?
Mm-hmm. Well, they are immensely funny to a certain eye, it seems to me, and terrifying as well.
Yeah.
And I think that is the odd thing. People, it's as if it's a fabric of two sides. People will see the terrifying side, but not the funny side. This was the problem always in prose with Kafka, but I think it was the problem for Blake as well. I'll give you a for instance. Critics read what Blake says as shocking when he says, "I would sooner strangle a baby than harbor an impure thought." Now, Blake is not intending any threat to babies. He doesn't mean he wants to strangle babies.
Right.
He means he's not going to keep anything silent. And he thinks this is so important that he would jeopardize a child rather than block the self.
Mm.
And it seems to me that this is the double-sidedness of your work as well, especially as regards babies and silence.
You know what I read about him in a biography, that he was one kind of person, and then for some offense, I don't remember what it was, he received a terrible beating from his mother, and he could never go back to school. He could never do the things that he had done in his life previous to that. That his whole life was going this way, and then it went that way. Which seemed, I've always, you know, how it is that we love them, and we wish we could do something, you know. And when I learned that, it was, that just comes into my mind when I'm, you know, when you mention him. I heard of that recently. Yeah. We love you, William Blake.
You know, sometimes phrases come back from my childhood that I wish I couldn't hear. I'm thinking of one in particular, which was my father saying to my mother, "Not in the head, Lorraine," meaning that she could hit me anywhere, but not in the head. And I wonder, when you're working with your students, do you work with them on the projects of unblocking?
I don't know. That's such a... I'm just so struck by that line. It's like a line, you know.
Give me your hand. There you go. There you go. We held hands a bit before to get our
both
nerves.
Have trembling hands.
That's a great question, and I don't know. I don't know what happens because everyone brings in a first draft. My favorite working is when I'm in a weekend thing or a week-long thing where everyone, if there are 10 of us around the table, 10 of us bring in a brand new first draft every morning. Sometimes in the morning and then in the afternoon and then twice the next day too. And
a brand new first
draft. Brand new first draft. And what we're doing is, I think, wanting to salute, to greet, to praise, to be thankful for what is most alive and exciting to us and moving, what's the strongest and the best, what's unforgettable, like that sentence line. And so each one encourages the others according to what moves each one of us the most. What seems to happen over such an arc is that we do end up remembering things we hadn't remembered, imagining things we hadn't imagined, inventing things we hadn't invented, telling lies of great beauty and valor that make our best poems sometimes that we've never done before, whatever, in the companionship with each other. So I think that, in a way, describes what you are describing. Yeah, unblock. Or something we know, we've remembered or invented, or it's out in the world, but we suddenly see a way of going into it that would be a work of art, maybe. One kind of work of art. Because until there's a way, until there's a way in, a beginning, a first line that is kind of secretly saturated with craft and form and order, though maybe only I can see it now, or maybe I can't even really quite see it, because if it doesn't have that, if it isn't really artful in some way and echoing itself and, you know, shapely and suspenseful or the way art is, the way rhyme is erotic, it says, something's coming, wait for it, wait a little, here it is. All of that, I can't start to write something unless I see that way to begin. Yeah.
Because I do a radio show.
I know.
It airs in the city where my parents live, and they make a point of listening to it, which truly surprises me, because when I used to say the very things that I say on the radio, my parents would say, or particularly my father, speak in English. Now they are very proud. And I've wondered how you've dealt with the others hearing the things they feel you shouldn't have said.
Mm-mm. One way I've dealt with that is that by now, it must be 20 years ago, I made a vow that I would never talk about actual family. It was a little late to make such a vow, but I figured the least I could do was to make one. I have such a powerful sense of the separateness of life and art. They seem so far apart to me. A work of art is so unlike the senses and everything. It's, you know, paper, ink. I was just realizing today, paper is trees, ink is shellfish shells. So when I'm saying paper and ink, it's like vegetable, you know, animal, mineral, I was just thinking about that today, which is how I just lost my train of thought.
Well, aren't you like being separate?
Yeah. They're so different. And I felt that some of that sense in me of that difference might have to do with having grown up in a church where there were worlds that coexisted so that there could be hell in the same space that we're in now, but at an angle and invisible, and heaven too, that heaven was more real than earth, hell was more real than earth, and they might have contiguous oblique planes shared, or it was hard to figure out.
And coexistent.
Coexisting, but separate worlds. Separate worlds. And so I think something about, you know, separate worlds got into my mind very early. Also, I wanted to do what I wanted to do in terms of writing and what you said before about speaking. So I think I sort of used a little sociopathic denial about the possibility of the worlds coming together. But then when I realized, you know, we never think anyone's going to read our poems. Who's going to ever read a poem? And then when good fortune and danger appear together, then I made this vow. And so in a way, that's how I handle it, is by, you know, not handling it or not talking about it. That's it. Though these are some of the most important questions that we can talk about, and especially with, you know, writing students. And so then with them, I completely talk about it all theoretically, all the range of choices we have, what loyalty is. If you don't feel it, why not? You know, if you can trust your instincts about whether to put something out, how to get it out there in an alias, or when, or put it in a drawer for 100 years, or all those things. So the subject is very important, but I can't talk about it in terms of my own.
And I don't want you to. Right. I'm interested in the poetic practice, not in the personal
exactly.
practice.
Exactly, yeah.
But it does seem to me that danger and risk are very important in the aesthetic process for you.
Well, I'm a big chicken.
Are you?
Yeah.
In what way?
I'm scared a lot. You know, like a lot, you know, like we are. Yeah. We aren't. They're. I am. Do you know, just nervous and scared. I mean, yeah, worry. I worry.
Well, I do too, but don't you think? I mean, I know, for instance, I was saying to someone at the foundation the other day, if there is something to worry about, I will worry about it. Please pay it no mind. I by now know that I'm not really scared. It's become, worry and fear have become a way of life, and they make me alert to things that might go unnoticed by others.
That is so cool. That is so cool. I think that you know, worry and fear for me blind me to reality.
Does that help?
No.
No, but it might help in writing.
Oh, well, when writing, I'm not worried. I mean, when writing, the pleasure of running, of forming letters, it's like dancing, the pleasure of the Bic medium point with octagonal, because the ink comes out really better than in the round white ones, and the ShopRite notebook or Safeway or, you know, the notebook, and you can feel those faint pale blue lines, just the pleasure of writing, and then no one is there. I mean, no one but me, and in a way, I'm not too there. You know, I'm as little there as possible in terms of self-consciousness. I don't know, it just... But I always thought that about art. You know, even when I was a kid, there was life, there was religion, there was, you know, all this other stuff. But then somehow I got the idea there was this place called art. I couldn't have said this, but I realized later that maybe God didn't own it the way he owned everything else.
That's so profound to me. I have an unfortunate habit. I believe that an interviewer should be as much a part of the interview as the interviewee. So pardon me.
We agree.
And I think that if you don't give anything, you don't get anything. But what this reminds me of are two things. One, you're saying that you like the process of writing. It reminds me of one of the dearest things in the world to me. The copyist in Gogol's story, The Overcoat, his name is Akaki Akakievich. He's a law copyist, and he says that he likes certain letters more than others because the E, and especially the crook in the L, allow him to look through them to another world. Oh. I mean, I think that's what you're describing. Mm. And the other thing it reminds me of, the thing about God not having control over the world of art, you know, Kafka wrote a letter to his father saying, I see a huge map of the world, and you are lying on it. And the countries you do not cover, there is no such thing as marriage. And in the countries that you do cover, I could not possibly get married. And that was his explanation for remaining single. Well, we all know what fathers do.
I think that I was also especially blessed when I got older. There were poets like, speaking of fathers and mothers, these are the mothers that are coming to my mind specifically are like Ruth Stone, Gwendolyn Brooks, Muriel Rukeyser, women. I grew up in a very sexist world, but there were just great things about women that I knew about, you know, when I was a kid, like milk, real milk. They like made real milk. I mean, just, you know, talk about metaphor. What an amazing thing. That all seemed powerful to me, very powerful. And then when I got older, these makers of poems, and who... When I met them, I also, as I got much older, got to meet them, their generosity and their courage, and just unimaginable to me. I mean, thinking of Miss Brooks, what she did, what she wrote, where she came to, where she came from, and what she made, you know, it just fills you with joy.
What was the... I know that you were in... a kind of poetry appreciation class with Muriel Rukeyser.
Yeah.
What was it like to do that? It wasn't exactly a creative writing class, but it had unusual aspects, as I understand it.
We would memorize poems and recite them. Then we'd read a poem... Then she'd take a pied beauty, and each person would read it aloud around the
table.
Everyone. 10 of us, yeah.
The Hopkins.
And then we'd close our books, and she'd say, okay, what's the first line? And then we'd argue, you know, because someone said, no, that comes later because...
That's brilliant.
Oh, it was
what a
so
process.
Good. It was
yeah.
so good. And she had... She was not well physically, but she was so, you know, powerful spiritually. And what's really coming into my mind, since it's this intimate setting and it's just us here, I can say, is that I realized that I had had many, that I had loved many teachers of mine, and that sometimes I assumed they knew or I hadn't told them. And especially when I was a kid, Elmer Sitkin, Dorothy Maines, Marilyn Krikorian, I didn't know to say to them, you're saving my life. And so with Muriel, I thought, I love her. And so every time I saw her, I took her a present. She just knew I just was in love with her. I just loved her. And I made that decision because I knew that I could, you know, be chicken. And I said, I'm not going to do that. She's going to know. So that's what I actually, one of the things I remember is that she had the kind of, she's not a chicken. She had that kind of spirit that would inspire the rest of us to, you know, be out there where our hearts were, even if, you know, it made us nervous.
I wrote a love letter to a famous writer last night, and because I haven't heard back yet, I'm even at this moment thinking that I'd overstepped my boundaries, because it was not a letter, it was a letter of a kind of admiration that had turned into love. And I thought, well, what will happen when it's received?
Right.
Does that happen to you? I mean, you speak about bringing presents to Muriel and needing to brace yourself.
Yeah, well, I didn't really need to. I just thought I did, you know. What do you mean, Michael, does that happen to me? Do I try to, if I think something is great, do I try to write it to them in a letter and mail it? Yes. With pretty stamps, yes.
And in a poem?
In a poem?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you mean in a poem?
Well, sometimes the poems seem to me like gifts, although the person, even the person within the poem, I mean, let's ignore identities. The person or the character within the poem might not perceive it as a gift, but when I'm reading it, I'm seeing so much clarity in it that I can see that it is a gift. And it seems that sometimes there are gifts that one becomes afraid to give.
Hmm. Isn't that wonderful about art, that you can speak to someone and try to say, or invent a speech to someone, or speak to someone invented? I'm always trying to not sound too in the clutches of autobiography, but in the clutches, in the beautiful clutches of art, of, you know, whatever it's doing with invention and memory, or memory, that there's this place that you can talk to someone you can't talk to, that you can say, try to say the whole thing, try to say all the aspects of it in a way that you might not be able to. And also, love drives you to praise and to want to give, to give a gift. It's just, because you're giving a gift back, really.
Now, you mentioned before, and I'm very interested in it, that you bring your students from NYU to the hospital. I think this is work with paralyzed people.
Yeah.
Can you tell about it?
I think it's 17 years ago now. An arts group, very special arts, came to me and asked me if I would teach an eight-week poetry writing workshop at Sigismund Goldwater Memorial Hospital on Roosevelt Island, the old welfare island in New York City. And so I started, and then I realized that an eight-week, you know, they had seed money for 8 weeks, and I realized what that meant. It would stop forever after 8 weeks. So I began to look at seed money a little. I began to think there was something onanistic about seed money sometimes, where, you know, it might fall on stony ground. And so I began, with NYU's help, to try to set up a program that would last. And now our students teach there. I don't teach there anymore, but I'm, they call me the founding mom of the program. And Melissa Hammerly, who is our director of the creative writing program at NYU, is the present mom of that program.
But I'm so interested. Part of the creative writing program is for poets to go and work with people who often cannot speak or write.
Right.
And they nod letter by letter to write their poems?
Yeah. Say you're coming to work with me and I've been making up a poem and I'm non-speaking and non-moving. Then you would hold up a cardboard alphabet card and you'd point to the A and then the B and then the C and then the D. And when you got to the letter that was the first letter of the first word of the first line of my poem, I would raise my eyes. That means you got it. And you would write it down.
How long does it take to compose a poem in this way?
Usually the composition takes place over the week before the tutorial sessions. But it's sort of like with, you know, Abraham Lincoln's legs being long enough to reach the ground. It takes exactly the amount of time it takes. You know? Yeah. And it's an amazing process. NYU now has, and other writing programs also, and I need hardly talk about this kind of thing at all, you know, around the Land and Angels, but it's built into graduate creative writing now at NYU. This hospital, which is a 900-bed state hospital for the severely physically challenged. There's a high school for special ed, a high school for special ed gifted, a women's prison, an oncology ward for children, and our students have a chance to experience that poetry can mean something to any of us, as well as to bring it as a gift to people who can use it.
Now, I know it's hard to put into words, but what have you learned from that kind of work as a poet?
I got to meet people who are spiritually powerful, who are unimaginably heroes, you know, who are funny and there, and this is the life that they are living, and they are living it. And when you see them, your heart, you feel better. And and I've learned that if you communicate with an institution as if they've had this program for years and it's a part of them to have this program, they'll believe you.
Yes, I always tell, when I started doing the program, I would say to the writer, I want to talk to you as if literary conversation were still common.
Yes.
And I think that listeners believe that it is as a result. You know, it's a kind of, you know, like secret. You know,
right.
You can infiltrate the world with the things
right.
you want to see in it. I want to say, in the process of preparing, I read several interviews with Sharon Olds, and we're talking about things that she doesn't generally talk about. And I want to express my gratitude before I ask a final question, which is not a hard question. I read that your dissertation was about Emerson, in particular about his metric, which is, if you've read Emerson's poetry, I remember when I first encountered Emerson's poetry, I was at Johns Hopkins, and I thought, oh, this is way too crazy. This isn't even poetry. This is doggerel. This is weird. Is he intentionally dislocating this? Is he doing it in a trance? And then I was astonished to see that that had been your approach.
You're now, the first person I've met who has had those same thoughts.
Oh, well, anyone who, you know, academics are, you know,
okay.
not feeling people, and by and large. And, And you know, but you know, if you read poetry and it means something to you, go to this, and you know, there is Emerson, the brilliant essays, the well-made phrases. You know that Emerson, if he wanted
yeah.
to, could have written yeah. a mellifluous kind of poetry, mm-hmm. an oratorical kind. But no, and I started thinking about your work in this way too, that people started by thinking of it as wild metrically, as unrecognizable in terms of its prosody, and, but in particular, that there's a strange clarity that I thought of in terms of what Emerson called the transparent eyeball, mm-hmm. seeing things as if only the eye were there, not as if a self is present, and being able to write them down, not coldly, but through only a passionate eye. And I've been seeing that, particularly in your emotional poetry and your love poetry. So I wondered if you would talk a little bit about what you learned from Emerson as a conclusion.
I love hearing you feel about him as I did. And when you say, is he in a trance? You know, yeah. And those... I'm thinking two things. One is that feeling in a way of not really being there while you're writing, at least not of wanting not to be in the way. And at the same time, you're the only place that it can all gather for this vision, in a way. And it's often, in my work, it often tends to be visual. And then the sense of, an ordinary life, and we all lead one, and it's so easy not to, what I'm thinking is the wish to save or preserve or protect or praise or make a little shrine to honor what and who you love. And the other thing is a kind of sense of invisibility.
That's what I sense.
When I went to college, I was so shy and I was so awkward and so self-conscious and I talked kind of slowly, and it was just like a horror to exist, sort of, you know. But I discovered that if I pretended, if I felt invisible, if I could feel invisible, I could talk, like if you were alone, talking, not afraid of anyone. And so I did that. And I've never thought of a connection between the two until you say that about our beloved prophet.
In your work, I've found myself, I can't tell you how many times I've written it over the years in margins of poems that I'd see in magazines. Intense passion coming from an invisible source. That seemed to be the way this was allowed to emerge, because otherwise there would be so many preventatives against it. Unless the self can be brought out of the picture, the passion cannot emerge.
Well, it's like people say, how can you read that in front of people? It's not I, it's not me, it's a poem. And so that's connected with the same thing. Well, you're just going to bring tears to my eyes with your great kindness and warmth and friendliness, which I feel, even though I can't see you folks at all, I feel it as a part of all of us. So thank you so, so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.